From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The Republican National Convention is set to open in Cleveland on Monday, and we begin our special week-long coverage of that with this report from RT's Guyan Chichikayan.
Donald Trump has put forward ideas that no mainstream American politician would dare. In the wake of terror attacks in Europe and in the U.S., he called for a temporary ban on Muslims entering the United States.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
From the very outset of his campaign, Mr. Trump called for a wall along the border with Mexico to stop illegal immigration. Each of these ideas, pundits thought, would bring an end to his presidential bid.
Donald Trump is a bigot and a racist.
Embarrassment to the conservative movement.
Yes. F***ing Trump.
But the pundits soon came to realize that half of America agrees with Donald Trump. A Reuters poll in June showed that 50% of likely voters supported a temporary ban on Muslims entering the U.S.
Many people in this country feel that he is speaking truth to power, truth to the elite. So I think that in many cases, he's giving voice to a lot of people who feel that their voice has not been heard for a long time.
As his opponents continued to defend American interventions in wars overseas, Donald Trump blasted them.
Our foreign policy is a complete and total disaster. No vision, no purpose, no direction, no strategy.
Later, even President Obama came to admit a lack of strategy on some of his administration's most critical foreign policy decisions.
Worst mistake.
Failing to plan for the day after what I think was the right thing to do in intervening in Libya.
Donald Trump injected ideas into the national debate that flew in the face of the Washington establishment.
We don't really need NATO in its current form. NATO is obsolete.
I believe we will have a very good relationship with Russia.
I think I'd get along very well with Vladimir Putin.
The more the political establishment and the media criticized Donald Trump, the more headlines he captured.
Many of the people who criticize him are viewed by Mr. Trump's supporters as people who are taking this country in the wrong direction. So they actually see criticism of Donald Trump as a good thing. They see this as a sign that Mr. Trump is actually pricking people in a place where it hurts, and that many of his supporters believe these people need to be pricked and hurt. Many of them see the Trump critics as people who are elite, as people who are out of touch.
Critics have blasted Donald Trump and predicted a quick demise of his political career, only to find out that millions of Americans agree with him. In Washington, I'm Ganesh Shekyan, RT.
Next, we go not to Cleveland, Ohio, but to the Central American nation of Nicaragua. One of the big issues dividing the Democratic and Republican presidential presumptive nominees is immigration. In this interview, we take a look at the view from Nicaragua and Honduras of that discussion in the United States, looking at the results on the ground of U.S. policy going back to the early 1980s with Stephen Sefton. Sefton has worked in Nicaragua and Honduras since 1986, originally on solidarity programs such as building school classrooms and on human rights issues, especially disappearances. Since 1994, he's worked on grassroots community development, primarily education and healthcare programs, in Nicaragua. Since 2003, he's been writing on political and economic development in Latin America and the Caribbean, and co-edits the website TortillaConSal.com. He's also a frequent contributor to both the English and Spanish language editions of Telesur. He also goes by the pen name Tony Solo. We spoke with him via Skype from Nicaragua Sunday. So, Stephen, you've been in Nicaragua on and off since the mid-1980s and living there full-time for about 22 years or thereabouts.
Yeah.
What's the view there? Immigration is a huge issue in the presidential campaign here, and the Democrats are painting Trump as some kind of Neanderthal on that question and a racist. They have their own baggage as well, and a history of policy that goes back as long as you've been there. In fact, Clinton was president when you finally settled there in 94. What do people see when they look at what's going on in the United States, and what's their experience with immigration with the United States?
Well, and firstly, I have to say that although I've lived in the region for often permanently for over 20 years and off and on for 30 years, and my view is still very much a foreigner's view, right? So, and although I'm very familiar with the experience of people in Nicaragua and Honduras of the immigration issue in relation to the United States, and it's important to understand that that's my perspective. I'm lucky enough not to have to need to go to even contemplate going wet back to the United States because my family's starving, you know?
Right.
So my perspective is not the same as somebody who is in that situation.
Right.
But there's so many aspects to that issue, aren't there? Why are there these high levels of migration from Central America into the United States? And I don't really want to talk about Mexico at all because I don't have any experience in Mexico, but I have quite a lot of experience at grassroots with families, most of whom. Have got relatives working either in the United States or in Spain, for example, forced to migrate for economic reasons because their countries are so impoverished after a century of neo-colonial domination under the essentially what the Monroe Doctrine,
right?
Right. And so the and so where I live. And I don't know a family that doesn't have a relative working in the United States, living and working in the United States in some shape or form, either legally or illegally. So, and very, very, and in economic terms, the family remittances that those relatives living in the United States send back to their family here in Nicaragua are hugely important in terms of Nicaragua's balance of payments. Just trying to shift from the micro family level to the macro economic level. I mean, that's there is a strong relationship between the two. So from that point of view, for ordinary families here in Nicaragua and also in Honduras, the economic importance of having a relative working in the United States is very great. And also that the collective macro effect of that is hugely important for the economies of countries like Nicaragua, Honduras, and Guatemala, and El Salvador. So, and there's a very, very intimate relationship, an economic relationship, and this demographic, this family relationship between families in Nicaragua and Honduras and the rest of the region and their relatives in the United States. And you probably know far more than I do about the economic significance of migration and into the United States and the importance of this low-cost labor force in for the United States economy and for the United States corporate elites. You know, and here I tend to see more the human effects, and I tend not to know a great deal about the overall economic effects. Mm. But it looked at historically, and I'd say that right from the 1980s, even when I lived in Nicaragua in the 1980s, when I was building classrooms in under the revolutionary government for the Ministry of Education back in those days, and building houses for people disabled, war disabled, And that's what I was doing back in the 1980s here. Mm-hmm. And that back then, the migration from Nicaragua was a mixture of right-wing people who said, well, I can't stand this revolutionary government anymore. We've got to move. So let's go to the United States, where we've already got some contacts and relatives and a support network.
And they were welcomed here with open arms, by the way.
Right, sure. And also, what also happened was that people who actually supported the Sandinista government also migrated to the United States during that time, partly for economic reasons, and partly, especially younger people, were sent to the United States to avoid military conscription.
Right.
So in political terms, it was a complex mix of migration from Nicaragua to the United States. My experience in Honduras was that it was just sheer impoverishment that was driving migration into the United States. And where did that impoverishment come from? In part, it came from the decades of neo-colonial looting and pillage and control by the United States and local elites of the majority population in Honduras and Nicaragua and the rest of the region. But also in part specifically from the time of the Reagan government onwards, right through the Clinton administrations, and the idea that Bill Clinton is some kind of progressive looked at from here is completely absurd. And because Clinton essentially consolidated the neoliberal free market voodoo economics of Ronald Reagan, this faith-based nonsense economics that benefit corporate elites and impoverish the majority. And for the United States people that and people in Mexico and Canada, that process was consolidated by Bill Clinton's promotion of the North American free trade agreement. But in Nicaragua, there was an almost direct control of economic policy. So there was a wholesale privatization of the public enterprises, the state enterprises that had been built up in the years of the revolution, and wholesale corruption by Nicaragua's oligarchy of the economy, and perhaps the quintessential symbol of that was the banking scandal, the so-called Saney scandal, towards the end of the 1990s, led by Eduardo Montealegre and under the government of Arnoldo Alemán and under the government of Ingeniero Enrique Bolaños, these right-wing governments. And it seems to me truly and kind of poetic justice that Eduardo Montealegre should be the United States' preferred presidential candidate, because he oversaw exactly the kind of bank bailout that has thrown the U.S. economy into stagnation. His bank bailout back in 2001 cost the Nicaraguan economy something like $600 million. Sounds like peanuts, doesn't it? But not when you realize that at the time the whole budget of the Nicaraguan government was barely $800 million. You know, so where does the impoverishment of ordinary people at grassroots in Central America come from? It comes from all that history.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that is imputed to NAFTA as an effect is the destruction of the peasant farming that took place, and the agricultural industry.
That is a key driver of immigration, because when I lived in Honduras, I used to do bits and pieces of research. And what happened in Honduras through the 80s was that the whole demographic balance changed, very much driven by United States agricultural policy, and which was subsequently consolidated under NAFTA. So what you had at the start of the late 70s, the Honduran demographics were something like 70% rural, 30% urban. And then by 1990, that had shifted to something like 60 to 65% urban, and 35 to 40% rural. And now the rural population is even less in comparison, and you know that ratio is even more in favor of, and what does that mean? What essentially the United States was doing through the 1980s was destroying implementing policies that destroyed Honduran agriculture in terms of the small scale, you know, family farm. That kind of agriculture, driving people into urban centers so that they would become a pool of cheap labor for foreign capital investing in the maquilas and the so-called free trade zones, and beyond that, driving people towards migrating into the United States. And that has been a very clear policy outcome. I'm sure it was intended and deliberate, right back from the 1980s onwards, as part of the neoliberal drive to kind of bring down the costs of labor for U.S. capital, both in the region generally and in the United States itself.
And then you have the continuity of this policy from even before Reagan, through Reagan and through the Clinton administration. Towards the end of the Clinton administration, you see the rise of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and the resurgence, or in any event, the rising of leftist politics throughout the region that in Honduras, for example, culminates in the election of Mel Zelaya, who was removed in a coup that Hillary Clinton helped to arrange, we've learned, and supports, while as Secretary of State, she designs a policy with President Obama that made him the deporter-in-chief. He's deported more people back to Central America than all previous presidents combined.
Right. And it seems to me that from... If you look at the United States government and its policy on migration, they're trying to manage migration both from a political point of view and from an economic point of view. The United States businesses and economy benefit from a certain amount of large scale migration from Central America and Mexico. But politically, they have to manage the costs of that, and it seems to me that that's the context in which one has to look at the immigration policy and the deportation policy of President Obama and whoever becomes the next president, and they want sufficient large scale migration to maintain the kind of the labor costs. I know I'm putting it crudely, but to maintain the kind of labor arrangements and the labor structure that is beneficial to the U.S. economy, but they want to defray the political costs by deporting people so as to mollify or appease the anti-immigration lobby.
Right.
So that's what it looks like from here. I don't know if that's the case, but you've asked me what the perception is, and that's certainly the perception. So one of the things that it's important to bear in mind is that now, as a result of these insane neoliberal policies, economic policies applied in the way they've been applied in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, you now not only have economic migrants as a result of this whole process, but you've also, it's difficult to know the degree of deliberateness of this phenomenon. But one of the phenomena that's happened as a result of these neoliberal policies is that a massive expansion, a terrifying expansion of organized crime and drugs trafficking. And so you've now got migrants who are not necessarily economic migrants, but they're kind of terror migrants. They're migrating out of, they simply cannot stay in their country because it's become too dangerous for them.
I mean, we have the example also of the political condition in places like Honduras with Bertha's murder, for example, and similar phenomenon around in that country, in Honduras, and also in Guatemala and El Salvador.
Yeah, and in El Salvador, things seem, and the Salvador Sanchez Cerén's government is doing its best to kind of cope with the phenomenon of organized crime and violence and the crime gangs, the Maras. But if you look at what's really disgraceful in my opinion in terms of kind of the way Western media in particular project the immigration issue and coverage of Latin America in general, is that they'll kind of report in an isolated way, for example, the case of the disappearance of the 43 students from a yacht in Napa, or they'll report in an isolated way the murder of 13 Mexican teachers demonstrating peacefully in Oaxaca. I know they'll report in an isolated way the murder of Berta Cáceres, right? But that as a phenomenon, there's a phenomenon of mass violence with the complicity of the state, not necessarily in the actual murders themselves, although in Honduras I certainly think that's the case, but certainly in the management and the cover-up of the cases. And when you compare that with what's happening in Venezuela, for example, and there's no comparison between the levels of violence and with the complicity of the states, that's the key thing.
That's right.
And that Venezuela does have very high levels of violent crime. But the point is the complicity of the state, one way or another. And you have that in Guatemala, in Honduras, and certainly in Mexico. And you don't have that in El Salvador and Nicaragua. And so when you look at Nicaragua, Nicaragua is an outstanding exception. It really stands out in the region because while there may be still quite high levels of emigration from Nicaragua to the United States, and there was a recent that you don't have anything approaching. There's no migration from Nicaragua out of fear of organized crime, for example.
Right.
And one of the interesting figures that I saw in a recent poll in Nicaragua was that there's a poll by this company called M&R, and they always ask the same question in this poll, or similar questions. And one of the questions is, how Do you think that you'd consider migrating to the United States as a way to resolve your economic difficulties? And that figure has dropped by something like 10% over the last 5 years.
Yeah. You know, Nicaragua also holds out an interesting example, even to people looking at the political situation in the United States, the issue of immigration and relations with Mexico, Central America, Latin America generally, is at the heart of one of the key issues in the presidential election, with the working classes, which is the part that preoccupies my attention, being heavily divided behind, on the one hand, both Bernie Sanders and, to a degree, Hillary Clinton, and Trump on the other hand. But you had a polarized situation that was actually a shooting war for a good long while in Nicaragua, and that has changed. How exactly has the government been able to bring unity to the working class in particular there, but also the society generally?
Well, by striking a balance between genuinely socialist redistributive policies and harmonizing their relationship with the private business sector, and to some extent that has been a function of the private business sector here coming to realize that the right wing political agenda of the traditional right wing political parties here is a complete dead end, and that all the private business sector here in 2006 was kind of crushed because of 10-hour-a-day power cuts.
Right.
Now, and the general impoverishment, there was no domestic market to speak of, except, right, you know, because people were so impoverished.
Right.
And what's happened since between January 2007 and 2011, when Daniel Ortega was re-elected, the private business sector benefited enormously from the socialist redistributive policies that enabled ordinary people to have sufficient disposable income to be able to become some kind of recognizable consumer market, which they weren't essentially in 2006. And also the private business sector has benefited from the massive infrastructure development, and in particular the electricity generating capacity, that has, there are no power cuts now in Nicaragua except for maintenance purposes. And so the private business sector has come to recognize that the kind of socialist policies that the kind of moderate socialist policies, if you like, that Daniel Ortega and his Frente Sandinista colleagues have implemented are actually good for business, you know, because you actually develop a prosperous population with disposable income that can buy things instead of a population that's living at subsistence level, just about able to feed themselves, which was the situation in 2006. And the private business sector has also benefited from this very state-driven infrastructure investment that has really transformed the country's infrastructure. And that's why you have this this stability. And they've also benefited from the security policies that the Nicaraguan government has implemented against organized crime. So, and you get people, you get businesses coming from Mexico, and these Mexican investors are astonished that they can walk around without needing a bodyguard.
That would be interesting development.
So, that's the economic reality here, but that doesn't mean that there's still aren't people who choose to emigrate. We know many people who've emigrated either legally or illegally, and it's a deep human tragedy when somebody here decides that they just have to emigrate because, for example, they've got into such deep debt that there's no way on their Nicaraguan income they'll be able to pay off their debt, something like that. So they'll then go into even more debt. I'm borrowing $3,000 to pay a coyote to get them wet back across the Rio Grande or something, you know, and then you see the effect that that kind of migration has on families, and it's terribly it's a family tragedy, really.
I'm just curious, finally, do you have any experience with people being sent back, let's say, you know, by the deporter-in-chief, President Barack Obama?
Yeah, well, I'm both here in Nicaragua and in Honduras. We know people because my partner's family has family members who've been unsuccessfully tried to go to the States, and also some successfully, but it's a personal tragedy, a family tragedy for those individuals, because what usually happens is that people who are so desperate to get to the States that they're prepared to go wetback and then try and enter the States illegally, what normally happens is that they're in a bad economic situation. They then have to take out a further loan in order to pay off the coyote, the kind of intermediary that gets them into the United States, only to be caught by the migración, the migra, once they get across the border, spend some time, sometimes many months, in a detention center, and then get sent back to Nicaragua or to Honduras, as the case may be in our experience. And they're even worse off than they were before. So, and because they not only do they have the debts that originally prompted them to try and get to the States illegally, they then also, compounding that, have the debt that they took out to pay the coyote, the intermediary. And so they're even worse off than they were before. And that's a terrible family personal tragedy.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.